Hello, this is Glenn Treisman, Professor and Director of the AIDS Psychiatry Service at Johns Hopkins Medical Institutions in Baltimore. I'm welcoming you to this IAS USA module on addressing psychiatric issues prior to treatment. Today, I will be talking about the following things. I'm going to talk about tools to evaluate depression, anxiety disorders, and bipolar disorder, the timing and frequency of treatment-related depression and prophylactic uses of antidepressants in patients who are getting ready to undergo hepatitis C treatment. In my first slide, I have a cartoon showing the relationship between mental illness and hepatitis C. As you can see, mental illness increases behaviors that make it more likely to get patients to get infected with hepatitis C. But hepatitis C itself affects mental illness and makes mental illness worse. More importantly, mental illness also interferes with treatment, increasing this vicious cycle and making hepatitis C transmission and resilience worse. In the next slide, I review some of the common psychiatric conditions in patients with hepatitis C. These include diseases of psychiatry, diseases of the brain, such as depression, bipolar disorder, and schizophrenia, problems of life experience, like the demoralization that occurs in patients with chronic illnesses, including hopelessness, learned helplessness, and frustration, but also trust issues, as many of these patients have had unpleasant, sometimes institutional experiences with healthcare professionals. The third thing on the list are dimensional traits, personality and intellectual problems that affect patients and hepatitis C. And lastly, addictions and behaviors, which will not be covered in this talk, but are covered elsewhere in this course. In the next slide, I make a few comments about anxiety. The most important of these comments is to point out that major depression often presents with prominent anxiety features, and the term generalized anxiety disorder often is used to describe people with anxiety, but not depression. Sometimes there is a tremendous overlap between these two conditions, and major depression with prominent anxiety features often is seen as generalized anxiety disorder. Increasing basic science evidence suggests that these two conditions are variants of the same fundamental problem and can be treated with the same medications. Other problems that present with anxiety include anxious personality types, anxiety-provoking like circumstances, panic disorder, and then, beyond the scope of today's presentation, OCD and other genuine anxiety disorders. Because patients who are anxious may have trouble completing treatment, it's important to diagnose and treat anxiety disorders as part of the preparation for hepatitis C treatment. In the next couple of slides, I'm going to talk about timing and frequency of treatment-related depression in patients with hepatitis C. Hepatitis C has a high prevalence of major depression as a comorbidity. In part, this occurs because patients with depression have increased risk for getting hepatitis C through risk-related transmission of the disease. Depressed people are more likely to engage in high-risk sex, more likely to engage in substance abuse, and less likely to take precautions. It's also increasingly clear that hepatitis C itself, by causing elevations in brain inflammation, increases the risk for major depression. And the third factor that causes this elevated prevalence is that interferon alpha itself causes depression. In fact, in other conditions treated with interferons, depression is a common consequence as well. Someplace between 40 and 50% of patients with hepatitis C have a diagnosis of major depression, although there's tremendous variability between studies, and it could be as high as 70% in some studies. It's important to know that antidepressant treatment is effective, and it's important to know that prophylaxis with antidepressants may be effective, and I'll discuss this some in another slide. In this next slide, I show a cartoon of the relationship between hepatitis C and depression. The important feature of this slide is that cytokines, stress transmitters, interferons, and immune system activation all worsen depression, but depression directly worsens many of these things as well, leading to worsening hepatitis C and worsening hepatitis C progression. One example of this problem is shown in the next slide, in which the intensity and frequency of depressive symptoms are negatively associated with viral clearance in patients receiving treatment. So patients who have more depressive symptoms over the course of their treatment are less likely to develop a sustained viral response. This and other studies suggest that depression is negatively impacting the treatment of hepatitis C. One of the common misconceptions is that onset of depression with interferon treatment occurs almost immediately upon starting the drug. While it is true that starting interferon causes depression in many patients, depression can occur any time over the course of hepatitis C treatment with interferon. This is illustrated in the next slide, showing that depression occurs over the course of hepatitis C treatment in patients. One of the conflicts and confounds is whether or not hepatitis C patients who have pre-existing major depression are being exacerbated by interferon, or whether interferon causes depression de novo. There is some evidence supporting both of these points of view. In the next slide, I show you that people with elevated baseline depression scores are more likely to develop depression during PEG interferon treatment. Depression itself is a complicated issue. Some people think about depression as a symptom, while other people think about it as the condition, major depression. Many research studies report depressive symptoms along a continuum without making the distinction between major depression and depressive complaints. In the next slide, I show two ways to think about depression: the categorical idea that some patients have major depression and that other patients have causes of depressive symptoms that are outside of major depression, although these overlap. You can see this in the Venn diagram showing demoralization, sadness, and grief overlapping with major depression, so that patients can have both, but that the two are categorically different. This is in contrast to the dimensional idea that major depression is a severe form of demoralization or sadness. I think the weight of evidence suggests that the first way of looking at things, the categorical way, is much more successful and much more likely to be supported by the basic science than the second. The question is, can we clinically distinguish these conditions? And if you look at the next slide, I have some of the factors that seem to distinguish between demoralization and major depression. Patients who are demoralized are distractible from their losses and their grief, while patients with major depression have a pervasive anhedonia and don't respond to most things that are good in their life. Demoralized patients tend to have initial insomnia, trouble falling asleep, while major depression patients often have AM awakening and can't go back to sleep. Demoralization occurs with a unique episode without family history, while patients with major depression often have had similar episodes in the past and have a family history of depression. Patients with demoralization have a stable life course, while patients with major depression, because of the episodic nature of the condition, often have a disrupted life course long before they get to see you. And lastly, demoralized patients respond positively to positive events in their life, while major depressed patients tend to be unresponsive to positive events in their life. Although the clinical distinction between these two conditions can be very difficult, in general, most patients, it's fairly obvious which condition they have, and treatment becomes more apparent when you think about it this way. There are a variety of tools to evaluate depression, anxiety disorder, and bipolar disorder in patients, and I wanted to spend a few minutes talking mostly about those used to diagnose major depression. All of these initially are screening tools, and in the next slide, what you can see are some screening instruments that have become useful in diagnosing or screening for major depression. All of these initially were scales used to evaluate the response to treatment in patients with diagnosed major depression. And only with time, they've become screening tools to look for whether or not patients have major depression. The most widely used tool is the Beck Depression Inventory, which self-report with 20 items, which also has cognitive and somatic subscales and is predominantly used clinically. Similar scales, the CESD, the Hospital Anxiety Depression Scale, and the PHQ-9 are all self-reported instruments that look at depressive symptoms. The Hamilton Rating Scale, which is widely used in research, is clinician-rated and is often used in psychiatric research as a second rating scale included with one of the others. It brings the advantage of being clinician-rated, but the disadvantage of requiring clinician time. In the next slide, I show you some of the validation of these tools for evaluation of depression. The first scale, the Beck Depression and Anxiety Inventory, or just the Beck for depression, are widely used tools. The only problem with these is that they're proprietary and they require that you purchase licensed Beck Depression scales from the publisher. The CESD scale and Zung scales are both free and are widely used. The Hamilton Depression Rating Scale is used less often because it requires clinician rating. In the next slide, I show an example of a Beck Depression Inventory. And in the slide after that, the Zung Self-Rating Depression Scale. Both of these are easy to use, easy to score, and widely used. The Simple Depression Assessment, shown in the next slide from Woolley in the New England Journal in 2000, is a two-question depression screening tool. While the study that validated this tool showed impressive statistics, this has not been a widely adopted approach to use a two-question screening. Many of the clinicians involved in screening for depression recommend using an interview for diagnosis and use the mnemonic Sigi caps shown in the next slide, in which you ask a series of questions of your patients about depression: sleep, interest, guilt, energy, concentration, appetite, psychomotor change, suicidality, and sex drive diminishment are the core of the Sigi caps interview. This quick mnemonic has been widely endorsed by depression-treating clinicians as the single best way to screen patients for depression. I thought it would be worthwhile to include a few words about treatment of depression. In the next three slides, I've summarized treatment with three classes of medications. The first slide shows the SSRIs, which are easy, relatively safe, have anti-anxiety effects, and are the most widely used drugs. They're all currently generic, and I have shown the doses that are my opinion of what doses to use rather than the FDA labeled doses, because I think these are more successful doses for treatment. Serotonin syndromes, although widely written about, are actually fairly rare in my clinical experience. They can occur, though, and it's important to know about them. While there are some drug interactions with SSRIs, in general, they're well tolerated, have a huge margin of safety, and are easy to use in patients with hepatitis C. In the next slide, I show the newer SNRI agents, including venlafaxine, duloxetine, desvenlafaxine, and milnacipran. These drugs are similar to SSRI drugs. They're more GI activating and more noradrenergic reuptake related effects. This includes efficacy in chronic pain and some anti-anxiety effects. Again, the dosing in these slides represent my opinions and not necessarily the FDA labeling. The last drug on this slide, milnacipran, is not approved in the U.S. for depression. It's only approved for fibromyalgia, but is widely used all over the world for depression and is probably as good as any of the drugs for the treatment of major depression. In this last slide, I show you some of the drugs that are in categories by themselves. First drug is Wellbutrin, bupropion, which is the most activating drug in the antidepressant categories. It has some risk for seizures, but that risk is relatively small and doesn't cause weight gain and is activating. In patients with intense fatigue related to hepatitis C treatment, this is sometimes the most useful agent. Vilazodone is the newest antidepressant approved by the FDA. It's not clear to me yet what its advantages and disadvantages are because we haven't used it enough. Some people think it's an SSRI and other people think it's more of an SNRI / heterocyclic-like agent. Fazone is a drug generally used by experts for the treatment of depression because of its rare liver toxicity. And trazodone is used usually for sleep because it's so sedating, but it's a perfectly effective antidepressant. I also have tricyclics and monoamine oxidase inhibitors on this slide, but you're not going to use them without expert help. However, you will occasionally see patients on these drugs. I wanted to include a few words about bipolar disorder. Bipolar disorder is very similar to major depression, but has episodes of mania as well as episodes of depression. It's far more difficult to treat than depression and usually requires expert treatment. Interferon occasionally induces manic episodes, but these are fairly rare. You may not know that your patient has bipolar disorder until you trigger an episode of mania while trying to treat the depression in your patient. While this is not an uncommon occurrence, it frequently is a reason for consultation with an expert. In this next slide, I have the manic episode DSM-IV definition. Although these are the core features of mania, most clinicians know what mania looks like because it's unmistakable in most patients. I wanted to finally talk for a few minutes about the prophylactic use of antidepressants. There have been several positive studies using paroxetine and citalopram or escitalopram for the prophylaxis of depression in patients on interferon. There have also been several failed trials. Because of this, my current recommendation is the following. If a patient has a clear history of major depression and has responded to treatment, prophylaxis with that drug prior to starting interferon is a reasonable approach, and I do it. If the patient has a clear history of major depression that was severe, I prophylax patients with the drug of my choice. In patients who have not had a clear history of major depression or have not received treatment, I usually wait until interferon starts to decide whether or not I'm going to treat patients with antidepressants. While these recommendations may change shortly, they're my current recommendations for prophylaxis. In summary, the take-home messages are you should screen patients for depression before treatment and at every visit after starting treatment. Depression can occur late as well as early. Seeing psychiatric patients more often and treating comorbidity improves outcome and decreases the risks of failure with a sustained virological response. And lastly, I strongly recommend collaborative treatment with mental health and addiction specialists in patients who are undergoing treatment for hepatitis C. Although it adds cost, it adds outcome benefit, and the outcome benefits far outweigh the costs of treating these patients and having psychiatric comorbidity treated as part of the package of treating hepatitis C.